do? Aren't they trying to shake things up so they can grab control? That's what they think they're doing. Actually, they're creating new extremists, new radicals, and they are continuing the old process. What about a radical who sees the complexities and comes at you that way? That's no radical. That's a rival for leadership. But what do? You co-opt them or kill them. That's how the struggle for leadership originated, at the grunt level. Yes, but what about messiahs, like my father? The Duncan does not like this question. He knows that in a very special way, I am my father. He knows I can speak with my father's voice and persona, that the memories are precise, never edited, and inescapable. Reluctantly, he says, well, if you want. Duncan, I am all of them, and I know. There has never been a truly selfless rebel, just hypocrites, conscious hypocrites or unconscious hypocrites, it's all the same. That stirs up a small hornet's nest among my ancestral memories. Some of them have never given up the belief that they and they alone held the key to all of humankind's problems. Well, in that, they are like me. I can sympathize even while I tell them that failure is its own demonstration. I am forced to block them off, though. There's no sense dwelling on them. They now are little more than poignant reminders. As is this Duncan, who stands in front of me with his laser gun. Great gods below, he has caught me napping. He has the laser gun in his hand, and it is pointed at my face. You, Duncan, have you betrayed me too? Et tu, Brute? Every fibre of Leto's awareness came to full alert. He could feel his body twitching. The worm flesh had a will of its own. Idaho spoke with derision.
Tell me, Leto, how many times must I pay the debt of loyalty?
Leto recognized the inner question. How many of me have there been? The Duncans always wanted to know this. Every Duncan asked it, and no answer satisfied. They doubted. In his saddest Muad'Dib voice, Leto asked,
Do you take no pride in my admiration, Duncan? Haven't you ever wondered what it is about you that makes me desire you as my constant companion through the centuries? You know me to be the ultimate fool. Duncan!
The voice of an angry Muad'Dib could always be counted on to shatter Idaho. Despite the fact that Idaho knew no Bene Gesserit had ever mastered the powers of voice as Leto had mastered them, it was predictable that he would dance to this one voice. The laser gun wavered in his hand. That was enough. Leto was off the cart in a hurtling roll. Idaho had never seen him leave the cart this way, had not even suspected it could happen. For Leto, there were only two requirements. A real threat, which the worm body could sense, and the release of that body. The rest was automatic, and the speed of it always astonished even Leto. The laser gun was his major concern. It could scratch him badly, but few understood the abilities of the pre-worm body to deal with heat. Leto struck Idaho while rolling, and the laser gun was deflected as it was fired. One of the useless flippers, which had been Leto's legs and feet, sent a shocking burst of sensations crashing into his awareness. For an instant, there was only pain, but the worm body was free to act, and reflexes ignited a violent paroxysm of flopping. Leto heard bones cracking. The laser gun was thrown far across the floor of the crypt by a spasmodic jerk of Idaho's hand. Rolling off of Idaho, Leto poised himself for a renewed attack, but there was no need. The injured flipper still sent pain signals, and he sensed that the tip of the flipper had been burned away. The sand trout skin already had sealed the wound. The pain had eased to an ugly throbbing. Idaho stirred. There could be little doubt that he had been mortally injured. His chest was visibly crushed. There was obvious agony when he tried to breathe. But he opened his eyes and stared up at Leto.
The persistence of these mortal possessions, Leto thought.
Siona,
Idaho gasped. Leto saw the life leave him then.
Interesting,
Leto thought.
Is it possible that this Duncan and Siona?
No.
This Duncan always displayed a true, sneering disdain for Siona's foolishness.
Leto climbed back onto the royal cart. That had been a close one. There could be little doubt that the Duncan had been aiming for the brain. Leto was always aware that his hands and feet were vulnerable, but he had allowed no one to learn that what had once been his brain was no longer directly associated with his face. It was not even a brain of human dimensions anymore, but had spread in nodal congeries throughout his body. He had told this to no one but his journals.
Oh, the landscapes I have seen, and the people, the far wanderings of the Fremen and all the rest of it, even back through the myths to Terra. Oh, the lessons in astronomy and intrigue, the migrations, the disheveled flights, the leg-aching and lung-aching runs through so many nights on all of those cosmic specks where we have defended our transient possession. I tell you, we are a marvel, and my memories leave no doubt of this. The Stolen Journals.
The woman working at the small wall desk was too big for the narrow chair on which she perched. Outside, it was mid-morning, but in this windowless room deep beneath the city of Ohn, there was but a single glow globe high in a corner. It had been turned to warm yellow, but the light failed to dispel the grey utility of the small room. Walls and ceiling were covered by identical rectangular panels of dull grey metal. There was only one other piece of furniture, a narrow cot with a thin pallet covered by a featureless grey blanket. It was obvious that neither piece of furniture had been designed for the occupant. She wore a one-piece pyjama suit of dark blue, which stretched tightly across her wide shoulders as she hunched over the desk. The glow globe illuminated closely cropped blonde hair and the right side of her face, emphasizing the square block of jaw. The jaw moved with silent words as her thick fingers carefully depressed the keys of a thin keyboard on the desk. She handled the machine with a deference which had originated as awe and moved reluctantly into fearsome excitement. Long familiarity with the machine had eliminated neither emotion. As she wrote, words appeared on a screen concealed within the wall rectangle exposed by the downward folding of the desk. Siona continues actions which predict violent attack on your holy person, she wrote. Siona remains unswerving in her avowed purpose. She told me today that she will give copies of the stolen books to groups whose loyalty to you cannot be trusted. The named recipients are the Bene Gesserit, the Guild, and the Ixians. She says the books contain your enciphered words, and by this gift, she seeks help in translating your holy words. Lord, I do not know what great revelations may be concealed on those pages, but if they contain anything of threat to your holy person, I beg you to relieve me from my vow of obedience to Siona. I do not understand why you made me take this vow, but I fear it. I remain your worshipful servant, Nayla. The chair creaked as Nayla sat back and thought about her words. The room fell into an almost soundless withdrawal of thick insulation. There was only Nayla's faint breathing, and a distant throbbing of machinery felt more in the floor than in the air. Nayla stared at her message on the screen. Destined only for the eyes of the God Emperor, it required more than holy truthfulness. It demanded a deep candor which she found draining. Presently, she nodded and pressed the key which would encode the words and prepare them for transmission. Bowing her head, she prayed silently before concealing the desk within the wall. These actions, she knew, transmitted the message. God himself had implanted a physical device within her head, swearing her to secrecy and warning her that there might come a time when he would speak to her through the thing within her skull He had never done this. She suspected that Ixians had fashioned the device. It had possessed some of their look. But God himself had done this thing, and she could ignore the suspicion that there might be a computer in it, and that it might be prohibited by the Great Convention. Make no device in the likeness of the mind. Nayla shuddered. She stood then and moved her chair to its regular position beside the cot. Her heavy, muscular body strained against the thin blue garment. There was a steady deliberation about her, the actions of someone constantly adjusting to great physical strength. She turned at the cot and studied the place where the desk had been. There was only a rectangular gray panel like all the others. No bit of lint, no strand of hair. Nothing caught there to reveal the panel's secret. Nayla took a deep, restorative breath and let herself out of the room's only door into a gray passage dimly lighted by widely spaced white glow globes. The machinery sounds were louder here. She turned left and a few minutes later was with Siona in a somewhat larger room, a table at its center upon which things stolen from the citadel had been arranged. Two silvery glow globes illuminated the scene. Siona seated at the table, with an assistant named Topri standing beside her. Nayla nurtured grudging admiration for Siona. But Topri, there was a man worthy of nothing except active dislike. He was a nervous fat man with bulging green eyes, a pug nose, and thin lips above a dimpled chin. Topri squeaked when he spoke.
Look here, Nayla. Look what Siona has found pressed between the pages of these two books.
Nayla closed and locked the room's single door.
You talk too much, Topri, Nayla said. You're a blurter. How could you know if I was alone in the passage?
Topri paled. An angry scowl settled onto his face.
I'm afraid she's right, Siona said. What made you think I wanted Nayla to know about my discovery?
You trust her with everything.
Siona turned her attention to Nayla.
Do you know why I trust you, Nayla?
The question was asked in a flat, unemotional voice.
Nayla put down a sudden surge of fear. Had Siona discovered her secret? Have I failed my lord?
Have you no response to my question? Siona asked.
Have I ever given you cause to do otherwise? Nayla asked.
That's not a sufficient cause for trust, Siona said. There's no such thing as perfection, not in human or machine.
Then why do you trust me?
Your words and your actions always agree. It's a marvelous quality. For instance, you don't like Topri and you never tried to conceal your dislike. Nayla glanced at Topri, who cleared his throat.
I don't trust him, Nayla said.
The words popped into her mind and out of her mouth without reflection. Only after she had spoken did Nayla realize the true core of her dislike. Topri would betray anyone for personal gain.
Has he found me out?
Still scowling, Topri said,
I am not going to stand here and accept your abuse.
He started to leave, but Siona held up a restraining hand. Topri hesitated. Although we speak the old Fremen words and swear our loyalty to each other, this is not what holds us together, Siona said. Everything is based on performance. That is all I measure. Do you understand, both of you? Topri nodded automatically, but Nayla shook her head from side to side. Siona smiled up at her. You don't always agree with my decisions, do you, Nayla?
No. The word was forced from her.
And you have never tried to conceal your disagreement, yet you always obey me. Why?
That is what I have sworn to do. But I have said this is not enough. Nayla knew she was perspiring, knew that this was revealing, but she could not move. What am I to do? I swore to God that I would obey Siona, but I cannot tell her this.
You must answer my question, Siona said. I command it. Nayla caught her breath. This was the dilemma she had most feared. There was no way out. She said a silent prayer and spoke in a low voice. I have sworn to God that I will obey you.
Siona clapped her hands in glee and laughed. I knew it! Topri chuckled.
Shut up, Topri, Siona said. I am trying to teach you a lesson. You don't believe in anything, not even in yourself.
But I... Be still, I say. Nayla believes, I believe. This is what holds us together. Belief.
Topri was astonished.
Belief? You believe in not in the God Emperor, you fool. We believe that a higher power will settle with the tyrant worm. We are that higher power.
Nayla took a trembling breath.
It's all right, Nayla, Siona said. I don't care where you draw your strength, just as long as you believe.
Nayla managed a smile, then grinned. She had never been more profoundly stirred by the wisdom of her lord. I may speak the truth, and it works only for my God.
Let me show you what I've found in these books, Siona said. She gestured at some sheets of ordinary paper on the table, pressed between the pages.
Nayla stepped around the table and looked down at it.
First, there's this.
Siona held up an object which Nayla had not noticed. It was a thin strand of something, and what appeared to be a...
A flower? Nayla asked.
This was between two pages of paper. On the paper was written this. Siona leaned over the table and read, A strand of Garnima's hair with a starflower blossom which she once brought me. Looking up at Nayla, Siona said, Our god emperor is revealed as a sentimentalist. This is a weakness I had not expected.
Garnima? Nayla asked.
His sister. Remember your oral history.
Oh, yes. The prayer to Garnima.
Now, listen to this. Siona took up another sheet of paper and read from it. The sand beach as grey as a dead cheek. A green tide flow reflects cloud ripples. I stand on the dark, wet edge. Cold foam cleanses my toes. I smell driftwood smoke. Again, Siona looked up at Nayla. This is identified as words I wrote when told of Garni's death.
What do you think of that?
He loved his sister.
Yes, he is capable of love. Oh, yes. We have him now.
Sometimes I indulge myself in safaris which no other being may take. I strike inward along the axis of my memories. Like a school child reporting on a vacation trip, I take up my subject. Let it be female intellectuals. I course backward into the ocean which is my ancestors. I am a great winged fish in the depths. The mouth of my awareness opens and I scoop them up. Sometimes I hunt out specific persons recorded in our histories. What a private joy to relive the life of such a one while I mock the academic pretensions which supposedly formed a biography. The Stolen Journals.
Moneo descended to the crypt with sad resignation. There was no escaping the duties required of him now. The God Emperor required a small passage of time to grieve the loss of another Duncan. But then life went on. And on. And on. The lift slid silently downward with its superb Ixion dependability. Once, just once, the God Emperor had cried out to his major domo, Moneo! Sometimes I think you were made by the Ixions. Moneo felt the lift stop. The door opened and he looked out across the crypt at the shadowy bulk on the royal cart. There was no indication that Leto had noticed the arrival. Moneo sighed and began the long walk through the echoing gloom. There was a body on the floor near the cart. No need for deja vu. This was merely familiar. Once, in Moneo's early days of service, Leto had said, "You don't like this place, Moneo. I can see that." "No, Lord." With just a little prodding of memory, Moneo could hear his own voice in that naive past. And the voice of the God Emperor responding, "You don't think of a mausoleum as a comforting place, Moneo. I find it a source of infinite strength." Moneo remembered that he had been anxious to get off this topic. "Yes, Lord." Leto had persisted. "There are only a few of my ancestors here. The water of Muad'Dib is here. Gani and Harkalada are here, of course, but they're not my ancestors. No, if there's any true crypt of my ancestors, I am that crypt. This is mostly the Duncans and the products of my breeding program. You'll be here someday." Moneo found that these memories had slowed his pace. He sighed and moved a bit faster. Leto could be violently impatient on occasion, but there was still no sign from him. Moneo did not take this to mean that his approach went unobserved. Leto lay with his eyes closed and only his other senses to record Moneo's progress across the crypt. Thoughts of Siona had been occupying Leto's attention. "Siona is my ardent enemy," he thought. "I do not need Nayla's words to confirm this. Siona is a woman of action. She lives on the surface of enormous energies which fill me with fantasies of delight. I cannot contemplate those living energies without a feeling of ecstasy. They are my reason for being, the justification for everything I have ever done. Even for the corpse of this foolish Duncan in front of me now." Leto's ears told him that Moneo had not yet crossed half the distance to the royal cart. The man moved slower and slower, then picked up his pace. "What a gift Moneo has given me in this daughter," Leto thought. "Siona is fresh and precious. She is the new, while I am a collection of the obsolete, a relic of the damned, of the lost and strayed. I am the waylaid pieces of history which sank out of sight in all of our pasts. Such an accumulation of riffraff has never before been imagined." Leto paraded the past within him then to let them observe what had happened in the crypt. "The minutiae are mine." Siona, though, Siona was like a clean slate upon which great things might yet be written. "I guard that slate with infinite care. I am preparing it, cleansing it." What did the Duncan mean when he called out her name? Moneo approached the cart, diffidently, yet consummately aware. Surely Leto did not sleep. Leto opened his eyes and looked down as Moneo came to a stop near the corpse. At this moment, Leto found the majordomo a delight to observe. Moneo wore a white Atreides uniform with no insignia, a subtle comment. His face, almost as well known as Leto's, was all the insignia he needed. Moneo waited impatiently. There was no change of expression on his flat, even features. His thick, sandy hair lay in a neat, equally divided part. Deep within his grey eyes there was that look of directness which went with knowledge of great personal power. It was a look which he modified only in the God Emperor's presence, and sometimes not even there. Not once did he glance toward the body on the crypt's floor. When Leto continued silent, Moneo cleared his throat, then,
"I am saddened, Lord."
"Exquisite," Leto thought. "He knows I feel true remorse about the Duncans. Moneo has seen their records, and has seen enough of them dead. He knows that only 19 Duncans died what people usually refer to as natural deaths." "He had an Ixion laser gun," Leto said. Moneo's gaze went directly to the gun on the floor of the crypt off to his left, demonstrating that he already had seen it. He returned his attention to Leto, sweeping a glance down the length of the great body.
"You are injured, Lord?"
"Inconsequential."
"But he hurt you?"
"Those flippers are useless to me. They will be entirely gone within another 200 years.
"I will dispose of the Duncan's body personally, Lord,"
Moneo said.
"Is there?"
"The piece of me he burned away is entirely ash. We will let it blow away. This is a fitting place for ashes."
as my lord says.
Before you dispose of the body, disable the lasergun and keep it where I can present it to the Ixion ambassador. As for the guildsman who warned us about it, present him personally with 10 grams of spice. Oh, and our priestesses on Gidi Prime should be alerted to a hidden store of melange there, probably old Harkonnen contraband.
What do you wish done with it when it's found, lord?
Use a bit of it to pay the Tleilaxu for the new gola. The rest of it can go into our stores here in the crypt.
Lord.
Moneo acknowledged the orders with a nod, a gesture which was not quite a bow. His gaze met Leto's. Leto smiled. He thought, we both know that Moneo will not leave without addressing directly the matter which most concerns us.
I have seen the report on Siona,
Moneo said. Leto's smile widened. Moneo was such a pleasure in these moments. His words conveyed many things which did not require open discussion between them. His words and actions were in precise alignment, carried on the mutual awareness that he, of course, spied on everything. Now, there was a natural concern for his daughter, but he wished it understood that his concern for the God Emperor remained paramount. From his own traverse through a similar evolution, Moneo knew with precision the delicate nature of Siona's present fortunes. Have I not created her, Moneo? Leto asked. Have I not controlled the conditions of her ancestry and her upbringing?
She is my only daughter, my only child, lord.
In a way, she reminds me of Harkalada, Leto said. There doesn't appear to be much of Ghani in her, although that has to be there. Perhaps she harks back to our ancestors in the Sisterhood's breeding program.
Why do you say that, lord?
Leto reflected. Was there need for Moneo to know this peculiar thing about his daughter? Siona could fade from the prescient view at times. The golden path remained, but Siona faded. Yet she was not prescient. She was a unique phenomenon, and if she survived, Leto decided he would not cloud Moneo's efficiency with unnecessary information. Remember your own past, Leto said.
Indeed, lord. And she has such a potential, so much more than I ever had. But that makes her dangerous, too.
And she will not listen to you, Leto said.
No, but I have an agent in her rebellion.
That will be Topri, Leto thought. It required no prescience to know that Moneo would have an agent in place. Ever since the death of Siona's mother, Leto had known with increasing sureness the course of Moneo's actions. Nayla's suspicions pinpointed Topri, and now Moneo paraded his fears and actions, offering them as the price of his daughter's continued safety. How unfortunate he fathered only the one child on that mother. Recall how I treated you in similar circumstances, Leto said. You know the demands of the Golden Path as well as I do.
But I was young and foolish, lord.
Young and brash? Never foolish. Moneo managed a tight smile at this compliment, his thoughts leaning more and more toward the belief that he now understood Leto's intentions. The dangers, though. Feeding his belief, Leto said, You know how much I enjoy surprises. That is true, Leto thought. Moneo does know it. But even while Siona surprises me, she reminds me of what I fear most, the sameness and boredom which could break the golden path. Look at how boredom put me temporarily in the Duncan's power. Siona is the contrast by which I know my deepest fears. Moneo's concern for me is well grounded.
My agent will continue to watch her new companions, lord,
Moneo said.
I do not like them.
Her companions? I myself had such companions once, long ago.
Rebellious, lord? You?
Moneo was genuinely surprised. Have I not proved a friend of rebellion?
But, lord,
the aberrations of our past are more numerous than you may think.
Yes, lord.
Moneo was abashed, yet still curious, and he knew that the God Emperor sometimes waxed loquacious after the death of a Duncan.
You must have seen many rebellions, lord.
Involuntarily, Leto's thoughts sank into the memories aroused by these words. Ah, Moneo, he muttered, My travels in the ancestral mazes have memorized uncounted places and events which I never desire to see repeated.
I can imagine your inward travels, Lord.
No, you cannot. I have seen peoples and planets in such numbers that they lose meaning even in imagination. Oh, the landscapes I have passed. The calligraphy of alien roads glimpsed from space and imprinted upon my innermost sight. The eroded sculpture of canyons and cliffs and galaxies has imprinted upon me the certain knowledge that I am a moat.
Not you, Lord. Certainly not you.
Less than a moat. I have seen people and their fruitless societies in such repetitive posturings that their nonsense fills me with boredom. Do you hear?
I did not mean to anger, my lord.
Moneo spoke meekly. You don't anger me. Sometimes you irritate me. That is the extent of it. You cannot imagine what I have seen. Caliphs and Umjids, Rakas, Rajas and Bashas, kings and emperors, primitos and presidents. I've seen them all. Feudal chieftains, every one. Every one a little pharaoh.
Forgive my presumption, lord.
Damn the Romans! Leto cried. He spoke it inwardly to his ancestors. Damn the Romans! Their laughter drove him from the inward arena.
I don't understand, lord,
Moneo ventured. That's true. You don't understand. The Romans broadcast the pharaonic disease like grain farmers scattering the seeds of next season's harvest. Caesars, Kaisers, Tsars, Imperators, Caceres, Pilatos, damned pharaohs.
My knowledge does not encompass all of those titles, Lord.
I may be the last of the lot, Moneo. Pray that this is so.
Whatever my lord commands.
Leto stared down at the man. We are myth-killers, you and I, Moneo. That's the dream we share. I assure you from a god's Olympian perch that government is a shared myth. When the myth dies, the government dies.
Thus you have taught me, Lord.
That man-machine the army created our present dream, my friend. Moneo cleared his throat. Leto recognized the small signs of the majordomo's impatience. Moneo understands about armies. He knows it was a fool's dream that armies were the basic instrument of governance. As Leto continued silent, Moneo crossed to the laser gun and retrieved it from the crypt's cold floor. He began disabling it. Leto watched him, thinking how this tiny scene encapsulated the essence of the army myth. The army fostered technology because the power of machines appeared so obvious to the short-sighted. That laser gun is no more than a machine, but all machines fail or are superseded. Still, the army worships at the shrine of such things, both fascinated and fearful. Look at how people fear the Ixions. In its guts, the army knows it is the sorcerer's apprentice. It unleashes technology, and never again can the magic be stuffed back into the bottle. I teach them another magic. Leto spoke to the hordes within, then. You see? Moneo has disabled the deadly instrument. A connection broken here, a small capsule crushed there. Leto sniffed. He smelled the esters of a preservative oil riding on the stink of Moneo's perspiration. Still speaking inwardly, Leto said, But the genie is not dead. Technology breeds anarchy. It distributes these tools at random, and with them goes the provocation for violence. The ability to make and use savage destroyers falls inevitably into the hands of smaller and smaller groups, until at last the group is a single individual. Moneo returned to a point below Leto, holding the disabled laser gun casually in his right hand.
There is talk on Pareia and the planets of Dan about another jihad against such things as this.
Moneo lifted the laser gun and smiled, signalling that he knew the paradox in such empty dreams. Leto closed his eyes. The hordes within wanted to argue, but he shut them off, thinking, Jihads create armies. The Butlerian Jihad tried to rid our universe of machines which simulate the mind of man. The Butlerians left armies in their wake, and the Ixians still make questionable devices, for which I thank them. What is anathema? The motivation to ravage, no matter the instruments. It happened, he muttered.
Lord?
Leto opened his eyes. I will go to my tower, he said. I must have more time to mourn my Duncan.
The new one is already on his way here,
Moneo said.
You, the first person to encounter my chronicles for at least 4,000 years, beware. Do not feel honored by your primacy in reading the revelations of my Ixian storehouse. You will find much pain in it. Other than the few glimpses required to assure me that the golden path continued, I never wanted to peer beyond those 4 millennia. Therefore, I am not sure what the events in my journals may signify to your times. I only know that my journals have suffered oblivion, and that the events which I recount have undoubtedly been submitted to historical distortion for eons. I assure you that the ability to view our futures can become a bore. Even to be thought of as a god, as I certainly was, can become ultimately boring. It has occurred to me more than once that holy boredom is good and sufficient reason for the invention of free will. Inscription on the storehouse at Dar es Balat.
I am Duncan Idaho.
That was about all he wanted to know for sure. He did not like the Tlaylax Sioux explanations, their stories. But then the Tlaylax Sioux had always been feared, disbelieved and feared. They had brought him down to the planet on a small guild shuttle, arriving at the dusk line with a green glimmer of sun corona along the horizon as they dipped into the shadow. The spaceport had not looked at all like anything he remembered. It was larger, and with a ring of strange buildings.
Are you sure this is Dune?
He had asked. Arrakis, his Tlaylax Sioux escort had corrected him. They had sped him in a sealed ground car to this building somewhere within a city they called On, giving the N sound a strange, rising nasal inflection. The room in which they left him was about 3 meters square, a cube, really. There was no sign of glow globes, but the place was filled with warm yellow light.
I am a Gola,
he told himself. That had been a shock, but he had to believe it. To find himself living when he knew he had died, that was proof enough. That Tlaylax Sioux had taken cells from his dead flesh, and they had grown a bud in one of their axolotl tanks. That bud had become this body in a process which had made him feel at first an alien in his own flesh. He looked down at the body. It was clothed in dark brown trousers and jacket of a coarse weave which irritated his skin. Sandals protected his feet. Except for the body, that was all they had given him, a parsimony which said something about the real Tlaylax Sioux character. There was no furniture in the room. They had let him in through a single door which had no handle on the inside. He looked up at the ceiling and around at the walls, at the door. Despite the featureless character of the place, he felt that he was being watched. Women of the Imperial Guard will come for you, they had said. Then they had gone away, smiling slyly among themselves. Women of the Imperial Guard? The Tlaylax Sioux escort had taken sadistic delight in exposing their shape-changing abilities. He had not known from one minute to the next what new form the plastic flow of their flesh would present.
Damned face dancers!
They had known all about him, of course, had known how much the shape-changers disgusted him. What could he trust if it came from face dancers? Very little. Could anything they said be believed?
My name. I know my name.
And he had his memories. They had shocked the identity back into him. Gaulers were supposed to be incapable of recovering the original identity, but the Tleilaxu had done it, and he was forced to believe because he understood how it had been done. In the beginning, he knew, there had been the fully formed Gola, adult flesh without name or memories, a palimpsest upon which the Tleilaxu could write almost anything they wished. "You are Gola," they had said. That had been his only name for a long time. Gola had been taken like a malleable infant and conditioned to kill a particular man, a man so like the original Paul Muad'Dib he had served and adored that Idaho now suspected it might have been another Gola. But if that were true, where had they obtained the original cells? Something in the Idaho cells had rebelled at killing an Atreides. He had found himself standing, with a knife in one hand, the bound form of the pseudo-Paul staring up at him in angry terror. Memories had gushed into his awareness. He remembered Gola, and he remembered Duncan Idaho.
"I am Duncan Idaho, sword master of the Atreides."
He clung to this memory as he stood in the yellow room.
"I died defending Paul and his mother in a cave sietch beneath the sands of Dune. I have been returned to that planet, but Dune is no more. Now it is only Arrakis."
He had read the truncated history which the Tleilaxu provided, but he did not believe it.
More than 3,500 years?
Who could believe his flesh existed after such a time? Except with Tleilaxu it was possible. He had to believe his own senses. "There have been many of you," his instructors had said.
"How many?"
"The Lord Leto will provide that information."
"The Lord Leto?"
The Tleilaxu history said this Lord Leto was Leto the Second, grandson of the Leto whom Idaho had served with fanatical devotion. But this second Leto, so the history said, had become something so strange that Idaho despaired of understanding the transformation. How could a human slowly turn into a sandworm? How could any thinking creature live more than 3,000 years? Not even the wildest projections of geriatric spice allowed such a lifespan.
Leto the Second? The God Emperor?
The Tleilaxu history was not to be believed. Idaho remembered a strange child. Twins, really. Leto and Ganima, Paul's children, the children of Cheney, who had died delivering them. The Tleilaxu history said Ganima had died after a relatively normal life, but the God Emperor Leto lived on and on and on. "He is a tyrant," Idaho's instructors had said. "He has ordered us to produce you from our axolotl tanks and to send you into his service. We do not know what has happened to your predecessor."
"And here I am."
Once more, Idaho let his gaze wander around the featureless walls and ceiling. The faint sound of voices intruded upon his awareness. He looked at the door. The voices were muted, but at least one of them sounded female.
"Women of the Imperial Guard?"
The door swung inward on noiseless hinges. Two women entered. The first thing to catch his attention was the fact that one of the women wore a mask, a cibus hood of shapeless, light-drinking black. She would see him clearly through the hood, he knew, but her features would never reveal themselves, not even to the most subtle instruments of penetration. The hood said that the Ixians or their inheritors were still at work in the Imperium. Both women wore one-piece uniforms of rich blue with the Atreides hawk in red braid at the left breast. Idaho studied them as they closed the door and faced him. The masked woman had a blocky, powerful body. She moved with the deceptive care of a professional muscle fanatic. The other woman was graceful and slender, with almond eyes in sharp, high-boned features. Idaho had the feeling that he had seen her somewhere, but he could not fix the memory. Both women carried needle knives in hip sheaths. Something about their movements told Idaho these women would be extremely competent with such weapons. The slender one spoke first.
"My name is Luli. Let me be the first to address you as Commander. My companion must remain anonymous. Our Lord Leto has commanded it. You may address her as friend.
Commander?
He asked. It is the Lord Leto's wish that you command his royal guard, Luli said.
That's so? Let's go talk to him about it.
Oh, no. Luli was visibly shocked. The Lord Leto will summon you when it is time. For now he wishes us to make you comfortable and happy.
And I must obey?
Luli merely shook her head in puzzlement.
Am I a slave?
Luli relaxed and smiled. By no means. It's just that the Lord Leto has many great concerns which require his personal attention. He must make time for you. He sent us because he was concerned about his Duncan Idaho. You have been a long time in the hands of the dirty Tlaylaxu.
Dirty Tlaylaxu,
Idaho thought.
That, at least, had not changed.
He was concerned, though, by a particular reference in Luli's explanation.
His Duncan Idaho?
Are you not an Atreides warrior? Luli asked.
She had him there.
Idaho nodded, turning his head slightly to stare at the enigmatic masked woman.
Why are you masked?
It must not be known that I serve the Lord Leto, she said.
Her voice was a pleasant contralto, but Idaho suspected that this too was masked by the Sebus hood.
Then why are you here?
The Lord Leto trusts me to determine if you have been tampered with by the dirty Tlaylaxu.
Idaho tried to swallow in a suddenly dry throat. This thought had occurred to him several times aboard the Guild transport. If the Tlaylaxu could condition Agola to attempt the murder of a dear friend, what else might they plant in the psyche of the regrown flesh?
I see that you have thought about this, the masked woman said.
Are you a Mentat?
Idaho asked.
Oh, no, Luli interrupted. The Lord Leto does not permit the training of Mentats.
Idaho glanced at Luli, then returned his attention to the masked woman.
No Mentats.
The Tlaylaxu history had not mentioned that interesting fact. Why would Leto prohibit Mentats? Surely the human mind trained in the super abilities of computation still had its uses. The Tlaylaxu had assured him that the Great Convention remained in force, and the mechanical computers were still anathema. Surely these women would know that the Atreides themselves had used Mentats.
What is your opinion? The masked woman asked. Have the dirty Tlaylaxu tampered with your psyche?
I don't think so.
But you are not certain?
No.
Do not fear, Commander Idaho, she said. We have ways of making sure and ways of dealing with such problems should they arise. The dirty Tlaylaxu have tried it only once, and they paid dearly for their mistake.
That's reassuring. Did the Lord Leto send me any messages?
Luli spoke up.
He told us to assure you that he still loves you as the Atreides have always loved you.
She was obviously awed by her own words. Idaho relaxed slightly. As an old Atreides hand, superbly trained by them, he had found it easy to determine several things from this encounter. These two had been heavily conditioned to a fanatic obedience. If a Sebus mask could hide the identity of that woman, there had to be many more whose bodies were very similar. All of this spoke of dangers around Leto, which still required the old and subtle services of spies and an imaginative arsenal of weapons. Luli looked at her companion.
What say you, friend? He may be brought to the Citadel, the masked woman said. This is not a good place. The Tlaylaxu have been here.
A warm bath and change of clothing would be pleasant, Idaho said.
Luli continued to look at her friend.
You are certain? The wisdom of the Lord cannot be questioned, the masked woman said.
Idaho did not like the sound of fanaticism in this friend's voice, but he felt secure in the integrity of the Atreides. They could appear cynical and cruel to outsiders and enemies, but to their own people they were just and they were loyal. Above all else, the Atreides were loyal to their own.
And I am one of theirs, Idaho thought. But what happened to the me that I am replacing?
He felt strongly that these two would not answer this question.
But Leto will.
Shall we go? He asked.
I'm anxious to wash the stink of the dirty Tlaylaxu off me. Luli grinned at him.
Come, I shall bathe you myself.
Enemies strengthen you. Allies weaken. I tell you this in the hope that it will help you understand why I act as I do, in the full knowledge that great forces accumulate in my empire with but one wish, the wish to destroy me. You who read these words may know full well what actually happened, but I doubt that you understand it. The Stolen Journals.
The ceremony of showing, by which the rebels began their meetings, dragged on interminably for Siona. She sat in the front row and looked everywhere but at Topri, who was conducting the ceremony only a few paces away. This room in the service burrows beneath On was one they had never used before, but it was so like all of their other meeting places that it could have been used as a standard model.
Rebel meeting room Class B, she thought.
It was officially designated as a storage chamber, and the fixed glow globes could not be tuned away from their blank white glaring. The room was about 30 paces long and slightly less in width. It could be reached only through a labyrinthine series of similar chambers, one of which was conventionally stocked with a supply of stiff folding chairs intended for the small sleeping chambers of the service personnel. 19 of Siona's fellow rebels now occupied these chairs around her, with a few empty for any latecomers who might still make the meeting. The time had been set between the midnight and morning shifts to mask the flow of extra people in the service warrens. Most of the rebels wore energy worker disguises, thin, grey, disposable trousers and jackets. Some few, including Siona, were garbed in the green of machinery inspectors. Topra's voice was an insistent monotone in the room. He did not squeak at all while conducting the ceremony. In fact, Siona had to admit he was rather good at it, especially with new recruits. Since Naylor's flat statement that she did not trust the man, though, Siona had looked at Topri in a different way. Naylor could speak with a cutting naivete which pulled away masks, and there were things that Siona had learned about Topri since that confrontation. Siona turned at last and looked at the man. The cold, silvery light did not help Topri's pale skin. He used a copy of a kris knife in the ceremony, a contraband copy bought from the Museum Fremen. Siona recalled the transaction as she looked at the blade in Topri's hands. It had been Topri's idea, and she had thought it a good one at the time. He had led her to the rendezvous in a hovel on the city's outskirts, leaving On just at dusk. They had waited well into the night until darkness could mask the Museum Fremen's coming. Fremen were not supposed to leave their Sietch quarters without a special dispensation from the God Emperor. She had almost given up on him when the Fremen arrived, slipping in out of the night, his escort left behind to guard the door. Topri and Siona had been waiting on a crude bench against a dank wall of the absolutely plain room. The only light had come from a dim yellow torch supported on a stick driven into the crumbling mud wall. The Fremen's first words had filled Siona with misgivings.
Have you brought the money?
Both Topri and Siona had risen at his entry. Topri did not appear bothered by the question. He tapped the pouch beneath his robe, making it jingle.
I have the money right here.
The Fremen was a wizened figure, crabbed and bent, wearing a copy of the old Fremen robes and some glistening garment underneath, probably their version of a stillsuit. His hood was drawn forward, shading his features. The torchlight sent shadows dancing across his face. He peered first at Topri, then at Siona, before removing an object wrapped in cloth from beneath his robe.
It is a true copy. But it is made of plastic, he said. It will not cut cold grease.
He pulled the blade from its wrappings then and held it up. Siona, who had seen kris knives only in museums and in the rare old visual recordings of her family's archives, had found herself oddly gripped by the sight of the blade in this setting. She felt something atavistic working on her, and imagined this poor Museum Fremen with his plastic kris knife as a real Fremen of the old days. The thing he held was suddenly a silver-bladed kris knife, shimmering in the yellow shadows.
I guarantee the authenticity of the blade from which we copied it, the Fremen said.
He spoke in a low voice, somehow made menacing by its lack of emphasis. Siona heard it then, the way he carried his venom in a sleeve of soft vowels, and she was suddenly alerted.
"Try treachery, and we will hunt you down like vermin," she said.
Topiri shot a startled glance at her. The museum Fremen appeared to shrivel. Drawing in upon himself, the blade trembled in his hand, but his gnome fingers still curled inward around it as though clasping a throat.
"Treachery, lady? Oh no. But it occurred to us that we asked too little for this copy. Poor as it is, making it and selling it this way puts us in dreadful peril."
Siona glared at him, thinking of the old Fremen words from the oral history. "Once you acquire a marketplace soul, the souk is the totality of existence."
"How much do you want?" she demanded.
He named a sum twice his original figure. Topiri gasped. Siona looked at Topiri.
"Do you have that much?"
"Not quite, but we agreed on—"
"Give him what you have."
"All of it," Siona said.
"All of it?"
"Isn't that what I said? Every coin in that bag."
She faced the museum Fremen.
"You will accept this payment?"
It was not a question, and the old man heard her correctly. He wrapped the blade in its cloth and passed it to her. Topiri handed over the pouch of coins, muttering under his breath. Siona addressed herself to the museum Fremen.
"We know your name. You are Teishar, aide to Garun of Tuono. You have a souk mentality, and you make me shudder at what Fremen have become."
"Lady, we all have to live," he protested.
"You are not alive," she said. "Be gone."
Teishar had turned and scurried away, clutching the money pouch close to his chest. Memory of that night did not sit well in Siona's mind as she watched Topiri wave the Chrisknife copy in their rebel ceremony.
"We are no better than Teishar," she thought. "A copy is worse than nothing."
Topiri brandished the stupid blade over his head as he neared the ceremony's conclusion. Siona looked away from him and stared at Nayla, seated off to her left. Nayla was looking first one direction and now another. She paid special attention to the new cadre of recruits at the back of the room. Nayla did not give her trust easily. Siona wrinkled her nose as a stirring of the air brought the smell of lubricants. The depths of Ong always smelled dangerously mechanical. She sniffed. And this room. She did not like their meeting place. It could easily be a trap. Guards could seal off the outer corridors and send in armed searchers. This could be too easily the place where their rebellion ended. Siona was made doubly uneasy by the fact that this room had been Topri's choice.
"One of Ulat's few mistakes," she thought.
Poor dead Ulat had approved Topri's admission to the rebellion.
"He is a minor functionary in city services," Ulat had explained. "Topiri can find us many useful places to meet and arm ourselves."
Topiri had reached almost the end of his ceremony. He placed the knife in an ornate case and put the case on the floor beside him.
"My face is my pledge," he said.
He turned his profile to the room, first one side and then the other.
"I show my face, that you may know me anywhere, and know that I am one of you."
Stupid ceremony, Siona thought. But she dared not break the pattern of it. And when Topiri pulled a black gauze mask from a pocket and placed it over his head, she took out her own mask and donned it. Everyone in the room did the same thing. There was a stirring around the room now. Most of the people here had been alerted that Topiri had brought a special visitor. Siona secured her mask's tie behind her neck. She was anxious to see this visitor. Topiri moved to the room's one door. There was a clattering bustle as everyone stood and the chairs were folded and stacked against the wall opposite the door. At a signal from Siona, Topiri tapped three times on the door panel, waited for a two count, then tapped four times. The door opened and a tall man in a dark brown official singlet slipped into the room. He wore no mask, his face open for all of them to see. Thin and imperious, with a narrow mouth. a skinny blade of a nose, dark brown eyes deeply set under bushy brows. It was a face recognized by most of the room's occupants.
"My friends," Topri said, "I present Iokobat, ambassador from Ix."
"Ex-ambassador," Kobat said. His voice was guttural and tightly controlled.
He took a position with his back to the wall facing the masked people in the room.
"I have this day received orders from our god emperor to leave Arrakis in disgrace."
"Why?"
Siona snapped the question at him without formality. Kobat jerked his head around, a quick movement which fixed his gaze on her masked face.
"There has been an attempt on the god emperor's life. He traced the weapon to me."
Siona's companions opened a space between her and the ex-ambassador, clearly signalling that they deferred to her.
"Then why didn't he kill you?" she demanded.
"I think he is telling me that I am not worth killing. There is also the fact that he uses me now to carry a message to Ix."
"What message?"
Siona moved through the cleared space to stop within 2 paces of Kobat. She recognized the sexual alertness in him as he studied her body.
"You are Moneo's daughter," he said.
Soundless tension exploded across the room. Why did he reveal that he recognized her? Who else did he recognize here? Kobat did not appear the fool. Why had he done this?
"Your body, your voice, and your manner are well known here in On," he said. "That mask is a foolishness."
She ripped the mask from her head and smiled at him.
"I agree. Now answer my question."
She heard Nayla move up close on her left. 2 more aides chosen by Nayla came up beside her. Siona saw the moment of realization come over Kobat.